Welcome. This is Zero Point Radio. My name is Christopher Holmes. I'm a PhD psychologist and mystical scientist. On this show, I explore the enigmas of human consciousness, models of creation, study of physics, modern physics, and ancient metaphysics. In addition, we explore the issues in our society, practical application of mystical teachings, and a wide range of occult studies, modern science, and social commentary. So welcome. This is, I'd like to thank BBS Radio again, and it's a pleasure to be back for another two-hour show. In the background there, I have James Moffat. Jim, welcome.
Hi, Chris.
And Jim and I usually have discussion. At times I lapse off and go into little mini seminars on issues, and then Jim and I pick it up and interact with questions and commentaries and so on. In the second half of the show, I'm going to give out some numbers and open it up for any listeners who might be interested in calling in. Okay, first issue. Jim, you asked me the other day, you had a quotation, and this is a quotation. The most difficult thing is to know what we do know and what we do not know. And the source of that quotation, Jim, is Tertium Organum, chapter first line.
Yeah, that's where that is.
Yeah, P.D. Uspensky. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And a very interesting quote, the most difficult thing is to know what we do know and what we do not know. Because from my perspective as a mystic scientist, as I've learned more and more, I've realized how everything I had once thought or been educated to believe in has been false. And in a way, so then, it's like at one point in my life, I was so full of knowledge of things that which knowledge I had acquired from without. In a way, in the educational system, we think to educate means to put information or content into people as though they're a blank slate, and we want to kind of write that information into them and condition them so they acquire certain knowledge. But in a way, this is all external knowledge. And the true meaning of education for Plato implied to educate meant to bring out that knowledge which is already latent or inherent within ourselves. So coming back to this quote, the most difficult thing is to know what we do know and what we do not know. And I think as we begin, at a certain point in life, once you've survived the educational system and cultural conditioning, at some point, you begin to realize how little you know of things. And in a way, the more you strip away the false knowledge and come back to not knowing, even being in the state of not knowing, the more we do that, then the closer we are to truth. And in my book series on Within Without from Zero Points, I introduce myself in the preface as a fool at the zero point. And I often represent myself as the fool at the zero point, and there's different reasons for that. One of them, in the Heart Doctrine, I quote Corinthians. It says, "We speak the wisdom of God in a mystery. If any man among you seemeth to be wise in the world, let him become a fool, that he may be wise." In a way, to me, becoming a fool, it means emptying yourself of knowledge, like realizing how much you do not know. And the more we empty ourselves of false knowledge, then the possibility is there that we might be illumined or realize things within ourselves. So this idea of we need to become as a fool that we might become wise. And the fool also, it's interesting, it's a card in the tarot deck, and it's in what's called the Major Arcana. And in the tarot deck, Uspensky once said the tarot deck is a mathematical model of the universe. And in a way, firstly, in the tarot deck, you have 22 cards in the major arcana. So we really there have 3 times 7, 21 cards. And the Fool is the 22nd card, and its number is 0. And then you have 48 cards. Oh, no, 40. It would be 46 cards in the Minor Arcana, which is 4 suits, each of which has 14 cards. So in the structure of the tarot deck, the Minor Arcana, to represent it, I would draw a triangle facing upwards. That represents 3 times 7. And then below that, I would put a point, which is, represents the Fool card. And then below, I would put a square, a box, 4-sided, 4 elements, 4 suits. So to represent the tarot deck symbolically, I would have a triangle above, a point in the center, and a square below. So again, the Fool card as the 0 point represents that point of transition from the lower realm and the Minor Arcana into the supernal realm. So if you look at the tarot deck in that way, then the Fool at the 0 point, it's like a portal. It's like between the material world and then the higher dimensional world. So that's another one of the reasons why I like this concept of the Fool at the 0 point. And so I tie it into this quotation from Uspensky. When Jim and I first began studying mystical ideas over 30 years ago now, we began most earnestly with the Gurdjieff Uspensky teaching. So we were very strongly influenced by what's called the Fourth Way teaching. And just brings me back to that quotation from Uspensky, the most difficult thing is to know what we do know and what we do not know. And often in this show, you know, at times I will talk about things as if I know, but it's like if you took anything I said and kind of pushed that to the limit, my knowing would kind of disappear into further enigmas and things I couldn't really answer. So we speak as if we know, but in a way, it's like we're trying to find our way in the mystery, in the unknown, to try to penetrate some of these profound enigmas of human life and human existence. The model of the nature of a human being, which I'm espousing through these talks, is dramatically different than anything you'll get within the educational system or in the mainstreams of modern psychology or science. I'm suggesting there is a higher dimensional physics and metaphysics to the human heart, that we are multidimensional beings, that we ourselves have 0 point centers or life centers associated with the heart. Okay, today our discussions, I want to begin by talking about some of Madame Blavatsky's use of the phrase 0 point, and then talk a bit about some of her comments on the nature of the sun and the nature of light. And so Jim and I kind of want to lead into discussions of holography and probably find other topics along the way. Okay, Jim, any comment about knowing what we know and what we don't know?
I was looking around for that quote because I certainly knew it, and I was trying to quote it because I was referring to the idea that what you basically just said is that in a way, even like many of these profound ideas which we can repeat and which we can even explicate in some ways, as you go into it, you realize that you really don't know that much about any of what's going on. I mean, I have one comment on what you said is that you realized about your education. I think in a way, you realize so much of your education has taught you false knowledge or things that are wrong, but it also a lot of it has to be relativized. It has to be put into a more comprehensive and coherent framework, and then it takes its proper place. Like everything's kind of out of kilter and askew because there's so many incorrect assumptions and preconceptions about the nature of things that distort the meaning of everything that we do know, you know. And the other thing I was just going to mention was that I always like when Gurdjieff, in Gurdjieff's teaching, he distinguishes between knowledge and understanding, and he says that, you know, that knowledge is the intellectual apprehension of something, but understanding is knowing it emotionally and sensing it. It's like it's enlarging intellectual knowledge into a more comprehensive framework of being and incorporating it into your being. So in a sense, he's sort of pointing to that idea of bringing out that which is within. You have to know it within yourself also. And one of the things that he says, which I think is so true, and if you just start to listen to people talk about almost anything, he said that when people can name something, they think that they understand it. And I think that applies to so many things that pass as knowledge in our society. You know, that people just think that because they can name something or label it, that somehow that they understand it, and yet that's completely false and really an illusion and a delusion.
yeah, the naming, yeah, exactly right. And we also, it's like Gurdjieff describes what he calls the formatory center, which is the lower function of the mind, which he says works like a tape recorder. So we go to school and we're told certain things. You know, you're told about Darwinian evolutionary theory, and you hear it and it impresses on your centers. And then at a later point in time, essentially you kind of replay what you've been told. And so then once we've done that, we kind of think we know that, we know that. Like I thought at one point in my life, you know, I went through, when we were at Carleton there, Jim, and, you know, I had come from a Christian background but was moving away from religion through high school. And by university, you know, I was just absolutely convinced, oh, Darwinian physical evolution, you know, the laws of nature, God, religion is dead. And in a way, it was just because I had acquired from outside of myself this whole other kind of teaching which has been given to me, and you can repeat that, and then you think you know that, and really it's just so much sand, so much verbiage.
Yeah, okay, I just wanted to add something to that, which is that I had a very dramatic demonstration of that. I mean, I completely agree with that. Like, I sort of had arrived at kind of an atheistic point of view on things and thought I understood everything, and I understood things intellectually. And I remember filling out this questionnaire on death and my attitudes towards death, and I put forward what I thought was an existentialist perspective on death because I sort of fancied myself as an existentialist. And about 2 weeks later, my mother dropped dead unexpectedly, and I realized that everything I thought I knew about death was completely irrelevant and completely imaginary, you know, that it had absolutely no meaning when I was actually confronted with death. You know, the immediate experience of it just revealed to me the kind of whole falseness of my belief system and my belief that, you know, that I knew these things. I mean, I was just so full of myself, and in that way, like, my mother's death was like a great shock in terms of just exposing that.
Yeah, exactly. And in facing that situation, all that thought just was just a product of your mind. It didn't correspond at all really with what you were feeling or experiencing within yourself. Did you have a sense of your mother's persistence, that there was something more, that there's some feeling of that?
Not really. I've often pondered that, you know, and tried to kind of make sense of it, but I don't really have any sense of it in one way or another, you know. Like, I mean, certainly my religious upbringing would, you know, say that there'd be some sort of persistence, but I don't know, you know. I had the sense, yeah. I think at the time you mentioned to me that you had a sense of my mother being, but she died fairly young and being taken because her work was kind of complete. And as I sort of, you know, thought about her life and try to get a sense of it, I think that's true in a way. Like, her work was kind of done here somehow.
Yeah. But irrespective of that, the point is that when it came to the real life phenomena, then the kind of intellectual verbiage and theories and such didn't...
Just dropped.
it was empty in a way. Yeah.
I just wanted to mention the story that you used to quote, which I think is a great story, when the professor goes to the Japanese Zen master and he wants to learn about Zen, and the master serves tea. And when the master serves the tea, he starts to pour the tea into the professor's cup, and he fills the cup, and he keeps pouring, and the tea is overflowing, and the professor finally says, stop, it's over full, you know? And the master says, like the cup, you are full of your own attitudes and opinions and beliefs about everything. How can I teach you Zen unless you empty yourself? And really, that's all of us in terms of trying to understand the mysteries of life and reality, is that we have to empty ourselves in order to bring out that which is within and to acquire real knowledge.
Yeah, and then that's so interesting too, because this whole importance in the mystical tradition of how our essential nature, in a way, exists somehow in the emptiness. Like, it's like in life, as I see it, everyone identifies with things and tries to acquire a fixed identity or a permanent identity, and people avoid the nothingness. Like, I argue in this teaching that there is a form of nothingness at the heart of being. In Kabbalah, this is described as the Zimzum contraction, where the infinite being vacates a tiny point of space. So the infinity of life is withdrawn from an empty space, and that leaves a vacated space within the human heart. And so the human heart, in a way, we long to fill the heart. We long to, in mystical teachings, to return to the Garden of Eden, to know God again, to return to the infinite. But that's the human predicament, is that we have this vacated space within the heart of being. That's why I remember, Jim, we were both influenced by the profound philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre and his kind of analysis of consciousness, where he talked about two kinds of being. He said there's being in itself and being for itself. And he says all kinds of material objects, they all have being in themselves. Like this desk in front of me, it is what it is. It has being in itself. It just is its own type of being. But then he says, but when you come to consciousness, he says, whenever you are conscious of anything, you are always conscious of something which you are not. So it's like there's always an object of the consciousness. So he says consciousness is this kind of nothingness, because it's not this, it's not that, it's not that. Mm-hmm. It's like this nothingness at the heart of being. And I'm saying it's because of this nothingness at the heart of being that enables us to be aware of all the things. So somehow the consciousness exists, or somehow to understand consciousness, we need to understand this concept of a vacated space. It's just like in the physical world around ourselves. We're aware of the physical world. Everything exists within space, but the space is invisible to us. But it's only because there is seemingly empty space that we are enabled to be aware of all the objects, all the things, because of the nothingness of space. So similarly, I think consciousness has some nature in terms of this nothingness at the heart of being. And so we actually try to look at that not only from a philosophical point of view, as you find in Zen and in other traditions. The Sufi says, not since God brought man out of nothingness has he ceased to be a traveler. So that's profound what he's saying. He says God kind of brings us out of nothingness. So in a way he says God brings us out of a formless realm, formlessness into form. And that's what I would argue. We come down out of higher dimensional space into the material form. So we come are brought out of nothingness, and since we're brought out of nothingness, then we're travelers. So we're exiled from the kingdom. We're exiled from Eden, and we have to find our way back to the garden. And that's why in Kabbalah we want to climb the middle pillar of the tree of life to attain to the higher realms again. But otherwise, our consciousness becomes more and more conditioned by the modes of nature and different planes of existence. So we lose the inner sense of what we are in the deeper formless nature of ourselves. And the other thing, what I was talking about, Sartre, and I mentioned the Sufism, the coming out of nothingness, and the other one is in Zen, it says we must become hollow like a bamboo. And that's like the hollowness is like, if we're hollow, it's then, and it's, our attention isn't cathected onto some object, but if we're in the hollowness, the vacancy, it's like that's the basis for the expansion of consciousness, because then as space, I believe consciousness can interpenetrate volumes of space. But not when our consciousness is cathected or tied up in different thoughts or different emotional concerns and so on. So the mystical path, in a way, is trying to strip away the conditioning that limits that consciousness. So in a way, as we strip away these things, the more we strip away, the more we get back to our essential self. And that's why sometimes it's said in most people in the heart, you want to fill the vacancy of the heart, and everybody finds things that they want to fill their empty heart with. So it might be possessions or nice clothes or positions or relationships. All these things we try to fill the emptiness. But in a way, like Sartre says, it's a futile endeavor, because the consciousness is always the nothingness. It's always the nothingness. So in a way, it can never have a fixed identity in the same way as an object of our experience can have a fixed identity. Consciousness is always this nothingness that negates things. Okay, any thoughts, Jim, or comments on the consciousness and nothing? So Sartre has this being for itself, which is consciousness, which has this particular kind of different ontological status as kind of a form of nothingness at the heart of being. He even uses that phrase in his book, Being and Nothingness. So it was interesting because we were both influenced by existentialism, but at the time I had no... I loved Sartre's philosophy, but at the time only was approaching it as a psychologist trying to understand consciousness and accepting his kind of theistic viewpoint, or sorry, atheistic in Sartre's case.
Well, I was reminded. I was just reading this the other day, and you're talking about this nothingness, and it's so counterintuitive because, in order to be something or to fulfill our heart's desires, we feel all the time that we have to do something, we have to realize something. But in a way, it's like the ultimate way of knowing is to be silent, is to be quiet, you know, that emptiness and that nothingness. And Meister Eckhart, the great German mystic, said, "Why do you prate, you know, like prattle, why do you prate of God? Don't you know that whatever you say is untrue? There's nothing in all the universe so much like God as silence."
Wow.
That's
Blavatsky's book, The Voice of the Silence.
The Voice of the Silence. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting.
In Kabbalah, it's interesting. They talk about five levels of the soul life. And the lowest level of the soul life, they describe as that experience of that peace, apathos, all understanding. And to experience that lowest level of the soul life, what you want to do is just still your mind and just go into that voice of the silence. and there's a certain kind of ecstasy, and there's that peace that passes all understanding in that, where everything on the outside can just be seem dissolved, and you're just in that place of peace related to the breath and the life in the body. And then there are other levels of the breath, but connected to other higher levels of the soul life. It's interesting in Blavatsky, all manifestations of spirit are seen as modifications of what she calls the eternal ceaseless breath, which is like a fundamental movement a fundamental movement in hyperspace, it's like the jitter in the quantum vacuum. The more and more you go into the quantum vacuum, the vacuum is never still. There's always churning, violent kind of quantum fluctuations on Planckian levels. So as you go into the grounds of existence, nothing is ever still, which is what Blavatsky says, nothing is ever still in terms of life. And the soul and spirit is connected to modifications of the eternal ceaseless breath. So it's like this breath comes down in five levels of it, and the lowest level of the soul is like this voice of the silence and this peace within the physical self connected to that soul life. I believe one thing really important in terms of healing that I see more and more is I think that we could develop faculties for self-healing, and the way we need to do it is settling into this level of our soul life and maintaining, abiding in that state, and through the breath that we can regenerate our form from within without. And so we kind of want to bring our awareness to this kind of sub-quantum level within ourselves. Okay. Any final comments, Jim, on nothingness and?
Well, yeah. You know, just in that last comment you made, you know, I realized just from observing myself that I see more how in my own physical being how so much of what I experience is involves my emotional processes and states and my thoughts, and how, like you were talking about things being affected, it's like they become attached to my physical body, and somehow they determine it. And I become, I think, more and more kind of aware of myself, how I can let these things go, like physically, like by being aware of myself physically and trying to connect with those thoughts and those feelings. Then I just sort of dissolve things by saying, you know, let it go. And so it's like sort of you're looking for that silence within your body, because your body is kind of continually interacting with your emotions and your mind and incorporating these things on a physical level. So, I mean, I see how what you're saying about, you know, like on a sub-quantum level, but, you know, the other side of it, too, is just sort of being more and more physically aware so that you can kind of empty yourself physically, too. Like, I try to do that every day now. Like, I try to go through my body and sort of empty myself, because I realize, I think as I get older, I just have a more pronounced feeling of how my emotional state determines, you know, my physical state.
Yeah. Something here I was trying to want to respond to, Antenna.
Just while you're thinking.
Oh, I was going to say, it reminds me also, I was going to bring it back to what Gurdjieff says about the levels or stages of awakening. And the first, he talks about kind of awakening, and you kind of realize the horror of the situation. Like, you kind of realize you're nothing like what you really thought you were like. When you begin to become more aware of yourself and your own inner psychology. He talks about how you have to be reduced to a nothingness in a way. It's like we've got all these wrong ideas about ourselves and our self-importance and these conditionings and attachments to everything. But it's like Gurdjieff says, it's like as we become aware of this, we realize our nothingness. So it's like you strip away all those things and you get back to your nothingness. So then he sees, like, once we get back to the nothingness, then that opens the opportunity for what he calls, like, the rebirth of in essence, that we want to be reborn. So there's this process of, like, dying to the old self and kind of getting back to the nothingness and then abiding in the essence. And then, you know, in a way we can embrace the nothingness. We realize in the nothingness is a certain fullness of being that there wasn't when we were always tied up in all the things, that there's a liberation in the nothingness. So Gurdjieff kind of describes those phases of self-realization.
Yeah, he says that to awake, to die, to be reborn. And in a sense, that's his teaching. But he said, you know, people speak of these things, but they don't understand the importance of understanding that these things happen to happen. People speak of these things, but they don't really realize what they mean, what to awaken means, what to die means, and what to be reborn means. And he says that they have to happen in that order, too. Like, you have to awaken. And I think at one point he says something to the effect that if you really observe and understand yourself, you have to be horrified. You have to see the false consciousness, the false personality in which you're bound and in which you're imprisoned. And so you have to, awakening illuminates that, and then through the process of purification, you eventually have to die to yourself. Like, you have to become a zero. Like, it's interesting. I have to become a zero in order to be reborn as a one.
Nice. You're a multitude. A multitude of eyes, a myriad of eyes, all your different feelings and thoughts and knowledge and theories and attitudes and all this stuff. You got that myriad, or what's it called? The legion.
Man's name is legion, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
and,
nice.
And
eh?
Then you. Go ahead.
Well, it's funny because you're so many things, you're nothing. But then in order to become a real nothing, you have to get over all those many things, and then you have to kill them off, and then when you've killed yourself off and become a nothing, then you can become something.
Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah. It reminds me. Go ahead.
I was going to say, in my book, I talk about that in my book, but I'll know my song well about I've forgotten, actually, because I haven't read my book for quite a while, you know, and I'm realizing, I'm rereading parts of it, and I'm realizing, wow, you know, I wrote that. I don't even remember it. But I have a chapter called Nothing to Lose, and it's like that Dylan line from Like a Rolling Stone, you know, when you ain't got nothing, you got nothing to lose. And that's what you have to kind of realize, is that you are, you know, what did the Gurdjieff call people? Terrestrial nullities or non-entities?
Terrestrial nullities, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's meant in a derogatory way, not in terms of realizing our... Yeah, but it's like everything we are adds up to nothing. That's how he's meaning it.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Like everything we think we are. Like, it's funny. Two things. I had two notes here. One was, it reminds me also of Nichol's comment description of self-study. He says, first we are one, then we are two, and then we are one again. So first we are one when we're just fused with the world and we just go about our lives in a conditioned state. So everything happens and we're just caught up. And then in a way we're a one. We're kind of integrated with the world. Then we're a two. And that begins when we start developing this aspect of ourself which observes ourself and starts being more fully conscious of ourself. So there we're making an inner separation between the observed and the observer. And over time, the observer can give up more and more of the observed and maintain awareness in that observer state. So then we go from being two gradually then to coming back to being one again. So so that's very nice, that whole going from the multitude to the emptying ourselves out and then through that process attaining the one and then becoming more and more established in that essential inner feeling which I maintain is connected and originates from the depths of the heart. The other thing I just wanted to say, in a thought in response to your quotation from Gurdjieff about waking up, where he says if a person isn't horrified at themselves, then they obviously haven't kind of attained that first level of practical self-knowledge. Because as you kind of wake up, you become horrified at yourself in a way. You see all your pettiness and smallness and all what goes in your inner world. And you kind of see that, and it can be horrifying in a way. But it strikes me that I remember when we first started working on the Gurdjieff teaching, I think I had a very strong sense of that at the time, like just seeing my mechanicalness and habits and so on, and gave me that feeling of being horrified at myself that allowed us to kind of persist with it, to move through that. And then it strikes me that last summer, it was like I, instead of waking up to the being horrified by myself, I woke up and was horrified by what I saw around me in the world. It's like, holy smokes, the world, we're ruled by a group of criminal psychopaths. Really, we are. Yeah. We're ruled, you know, and everything we thought, like America, what is America, you know, spreading democracy and love and caring for people and justice, and here they are, like, prancing around the world, terrorizing people. Not that the American people would do this, but what, you know, it's like what Christianity was supposed to be and then what it became. You know, what does Eliot say? Between the reality and the shadow, between the ideal and the reality falls the shadow. You know, it's like, you know, we have all these fancy words, but it's just a big lie. It's a big lie. There's this mass hypnosis of the world population, really. You know, that's how I see it now. It's like a major mass hypnosis intentionally fostered by the media. It's absolutely incredible. I can turn CNN on now. It's like a joke. You know, I can just see them, the kind of how they want to get people hating Iranian people now because they want to do another mass murder. You know, they haven't had no blood for a while, so they got to do something new, you know. So they try to get you all ready for it, you know.
In a way, though, I think that you know, I don't think that's true. And I think, you know, I agree with you about, you know, being horrified. I've been pretty much horrified by everything for the last 30 years, but more and more I see it, and I don't even think it's that intentional. By the media. I mean, I on some level it is, but another level it's just because they're mechanical and they're asleep. It's funny you should mention CNN. I was watching some.
Hello? Hello? I'm not sure if Jim's been lost or I've been lost or if I'm on air or not on air. I'm sorry, we may have some problem here. Okay, Jim. Okay, Don, can we get some help there? I don't know if we've lost our connection.
Sorry
for the interruption there. Well, we're both back online. Jim, I think you got cut off there. You were disagreeing with what I was saying about the media, and you watched something on CNN.
Yeah, and it was talking about whether or not intelligence had been cooked on Iraq, you know, and I find myself, I'm just going to say, I find myself just completely unable to even listen to these people. They're just completely ridiculous to me. But now, of course, what I meant to say was I believe everything that I hear on CNN as I was cut off when I tried to make this point. But, you know, what I was going to say was in a way, it's just like, you know, they're all part of I think you can overscribe intention to these people. I just think they're all kind of caught up in this series of interlocking lies and illusions about things. But it reminds me, I was going to bring it back to what we began when we talked about Uspensky's quote about the most important thing to know is what you know and what you do not know. And I remember years ago, you used to illustrate this point. There was a television program in the 1970s, and it featured little kids, and they would ask, the interviewer would ask these kids questions about something that they had no idea about. But that never stopped any of these kids from coming up with these incredibly convoluted and ridiculous answers, you know, where they prattled on about this and that, and really had no idea what they were talking about, but in some strange way, it sounded kind of convincing, you know, and you used to say that's a very good example of how we all are in terms of when we talk about what we don't know, I see more and more that, you know, that's my reaction to pretty much everything I hear on television, in terms of these people who are I'm supposed to take these people seriously. Like, these are supposed to be the conscious beings who run things. And I realize they're just sleepwalkers, and they're deluded, and some of them are quite evil, and some of them are just, like, they're just hapless dupes of processes that they don't understand. But the bottom line is that I just see it all as like it's this huge illusion, and it's like news by the sleepwalkers for the sleepwalkers of the sleepwalkers, you know. If people,
and to keep them asleep.
Yeah, no, exactly. And if people,
in a way,
well, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, in that great quote that we always quote from Gurdjieff, where he says, you know, can we say, for instance, that the world is run by conscious people? Who are they? Where are they? Instead, we see exactly the opposite. We see that the world is run increasingly by people who are the least conscious, you know, and he goes on, he says that contemporary culture requires automatons, and that people are more and more, you know, losing any semblance of freedom and respect for themselves by becoming these automatons. And that's what I see. I see mass culture and modern communications and technology. It really could inform us in ways that the human race has never been informed before, but people are more asleep and more deluded and deluded than ever before because of these, you know, these technologies. I mean, people aren't any closer to understanding anything because, you know,
it's
satellites. The opposite's true, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what's happened, I don't know if you heard this last week about Rosie McDonald on The View. Are you familiar with Rosie? Jim?
Rosie O'Donnell? Yeah.
Yeah. On The View, and she brought out, like, her questions about 9/11.
I mentioned it
on, like, and then there was such a reaction towards it, like some people in the States calling for her to be executed.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. And she wasn't even saying she thought the government did it or anything. She was just saying it doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up, you know. And then she was standing up for the Iranians, saying, well, you know, our media demonizes them. Like, no one can ever imagine the Iranians doing anything good. Like, it's this propaganda. And she brought up, you know, all the newspapers and the media are all owned by four corporations for the most part, you know. So what I see now is there's been an intentional fostering of this whole collective delusional system through the media. And I see them beginning to kind of, I think a lot of things are coming undone in the States. You know, I think the truth is coming out. I think there's going to, you know, I never really believed in this idea there's going to be kind of a quantum shift in human consciousness and everybody's going to wake up and so on and so forth. But I've never realized the need for it as much as that need exists at this time on planet Earth. I just so much see us as a critical point in the history of humanity. We're either going to become what Alex Jones calls a prison planet, and these elite, pseudo-elite people are going to kind of dominate the world with their cruelty and whatever. Or we're going to have this kind of massive awakening. People realize, like, wow, you know, what have we done? What have we done? What have we allowed to happen, you know? Where's the America we love, you know? It breaks my heart to see all the Americans kind of so deceived by their own, you know, like these soldiers sent to war. And they go, they're noble young men and women who try to face these awful situations. And then they find out that, you know, it's not at all what they thought, and they've been deceived. You know, it's a terrible situation, and you know, I see America's got to try to turn the tide on all these demons that have taken over. You know, I really see it as almost a demonic element that has crept into power and is overturning the American Constitution. It's undermining all the ideals of America. You know, a country that you have democracy, of kind of integrity, that believes in truth, all the high ideals of America, you know, which are just being subverted by these psychopathic criminals who have kind of bamboos taken over the country, essentially. You know, it's six of one, six, half a dozen of the other, whether they're Republican or Democrats. In a way, they're so much, it's just all on the same level. There's something that's so fundamentally off kilter in American society, and that then is carried about the world. It's transported around the world, in, you know, through cruelty and creating chaos and terrorize. I see the United States has become a rogue nation, has become the terrorist nation. They are the terrorists. You know, last week there was a 2-day weekend workshop in Ottawa called Integrate This, and it was sponsored by the Council of Canadians, trying to like create more public awareness of the North American Union and all these things being done behind the public's back by all these corporate elites who are devising all these new regulations to regulate trade and ownership of the natural resources and security and protection in North America. Imagine joining the United States for security, Jim. Wouldn't that make you feel safe?
Well, that's called security. We have been for the last,
You're right. And in ways it has afforded us security before. It's true.
It's all kind of very complex, but the bottom line is that, you know, this is, I mean, in some ways it's new, but it's an old story. I read this quote from Eisenhower where he said essentially about 100 people in the world ran things. This is in the 50s. This is Eisenhower, the president of the United States, and he wasn't talking about himself, you know, there's a power elite, an economic elite that controls things and that works behind the scenes to increase one thing, their power and their money. And they're really good at it, and they're beyond all sorts of principles, you know. It's become that much worse because there's such an incredible concentration in the mass media ownership of the mass media, and that's why this battle's being played out about the internet, you know, is that they want to control that too. And they thank God for BBS radio and alternative sources where people can communicate. But I mean, boy, they want to control that too, you know, like they want to be able to market consumerism, and they want to be able to control the content or control the thrust. I mean, that's the interesting thing about it all too, is there's always room for dissent in the media, and there's always room for alternative viewpoints. They're all there. It's just that they don't have the impact because the dominant message is controlled by the major media, and people have all sorts. I mean, imagine Rosie O'Donnell questions the truth of 9/11, and people want to execute her.
Well, that's a really democratic response.
It's a fight for free speech.
It's so absurd. Yeah, there's a great line in Catch 22 where he says the guy says he was daring to jeopardize his inalienable rights to free expression by daring to exercise them, you know? And that's basically it. It's like, you have free speech just so long as you don't exercise it, you know? And as soon as you say something unpopular, you know, some people want to execute you. It's just like, it's just totally absurd. I mean, the whole thing about Iran, too, as we talked about this before, but, you know, they want to develop a nuclear bomb, and you know, everybody's having fits, but, you know, the United States has, what, 20,000 nuclear weapons? And
I don't know,
something like that, 25,000,
yeah.
And Israel has nuclear weapons, and Britain has nuclear weapons, and France, and China, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, and then the stock response is, yeah, but these guys are actually crazy enough to use them. But the only country that's ever dropped an atomic bomb on anybody is the United States, you know, twice. So,
yeah,
if, you know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, you know, like, I mean,
who
cares if
and who owns the media gets to say who's who.
Yeah, well, exactly,
that's
you know.
Funny. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, it's all relative in the sense that people should stop moralizing so much and try to be more compassionate and more religious in the true sense of the word religion, you know, unified, and stop hating people because of the accident of their birth, you know, and the accident of their religion. It's the intolerability of people. I mean, you know, religious fundamentalists the world over, no matter what they perspective or what their religion, that just the idea that you can kill somebody in the name of your religion is, it's like Gurdjieff says, it's a deviated octave, you know. He said, you know, something starts out, like the teachings of Jesus Christ start out with the Sermon on the Mount and the idea of love and brotherhood and unity. And, you know, in the Middle Ages, you got people calculating how many angels can to dance on the head of a pin, and you got the Spanish Inquisition, which is torturing and murdering people for no good reason, you know? I mean, what happened?
Yeah.
What happened in between, you know? And it's still people call it Christianity, you know? Well, I mean,
I know.
Then there's Christians, you know? There's Muslims, and there's Muslims, you know? I mean, it's true of any... one of the great... confusion of tongues, you know, in terms of knowledge. People think that because they name something, they understand it. Oh, I know what a Christian is. I know what the nature of space is. I know what the nature of time is. You know, like, please.
Yeah, which funny, last night they had a special on CNN last night, and it was entitled, "What Would Jesus Do?" So I watched some of it. You know, they're asking these different kind of right-wing ministers, kind of, what would Jesus do, you know, and first guy, it's kind of a holy war, you know, and if they only knew, if they could only see, if they weren't so deceived, you know, it's amazing what's happened. Yeah, I couldn't believe it. There wasn't one person who came out and said, you know, we're mass murdering people, and you're not supposed to do that according to Christianity. It's not a Christian war. We're not defending ourselves. We are the aggressors, you know. It's just no one comes out and says anything like that. But at the same time, I read in another paper, there was a march several months ago of 2,500 ministers, priests, and so on in Washington who all got out together protesting the war. So, I mean, even within the church, there are these elements who are trying to kind of cover it all up and, you know, get people to focus on prosperity consciousness, you know, and why Jesus wants them to be wealthy, you know. They have that focus, you know, and then there's other people out there who are waking up to what's happening. So hopefully, I mean, we'll see. Is Christianity just going to be another force of hypnosis or sleep, or are people going to wake up and realize what's happened here?
Yeah, the same thing happened during Vietnam. I mean, you know, like, I mean, there were elements of the churches that were amongst the most, you know, progressive and most strongly anti-war, and the same in the civil rights movement. I mean, the civil rights movement was born in the black churches, you know. I mean, it was led by ministers you know, revolved around the church, essentially. And I mean, there's always these progressive elements, but there's always these people that, you know, think that Jesus wants a bigger defense budget, which always just blows my mind, you know. I keep reading the Gospels. I can't find that anywhere in there. You know,
yeah.
I mean, maybe it's just me. But again, it's like, you know, Gurdjieff says something to the effect that, you know, people read the Gospels in sleep, you know, awake, watch. You know, he said it's through the whole Gospels about the importance of awakening. But people think that it's meant metaphorically when in fact it's meant literally. Wake up.
Yeah,
you
literally.
Know, you are asleep.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And everything you
yeah.
think you know, you don't know, and you have to empty yourself in order to be something. And that's the other thing too, is that, you know, this whole idea of you know, religion is that religion consists of the what, like the knowledge, the catechism, but it also consists of the doing. You know, and as Gurdjieff says, who can be a Christian? You know, if you aren't master of yourself. If you aren't awake, if you aren't conscious, how can you possibly be a Christian? You know, it's self-deception to believe that you can be a Christian. I mean, some people make a better effort at than others, obviously. But as he says, there's religion of the sleepwalkers, and then there's the religion of people who are awakened. And you know, those people who are awakened, you know, there's a wonderful essay by Henry Miller, and he refers to them as the men of goodwill. It's in his anti-war essay called The Murder of the Murderer. And he says, you know, the men of goodwill have existed throughout the ages, and they owe no allegiance to any country, to any political cause, to any social cause. And he said, you know, they don't care if people disagree with them. And he said, in fact, they'd be frightened if people agree with what they thought. But they're all unified because they know a truth that is above the truth of the, you know, the average man's capacity to know and understand.
Yeah, or the kind of temporal, cultural.
Yeah, the temporal, cultural context.
Yeah,
which
conditioning and delusion. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like in the Bible, in Christian teaching, I think of this as being upright of heart, which is
right.
a Christian term, that we need to be upright of heart. Because I see the heart is like the central center in us, and three chakras below, governing money, sex, and power. So most people's hearts are kind of turned downwards and controlled by material nature, and they seek money, sex, and power, which is kind of what the world politics is about. And then it's only through the awakening of the heart, and then in a way it's like you go from the downward turned heart and become upright of heart, and then to learn to live in the heart in this special way. So
yeah,
I like that phrase, upright of heart.
Yeah.
But Miller was men of goodwill. Yeah, men and women of goodwill. I mean, that's what I'm hoping is happening around the world as people are waking up, and the men and women of goodwill and the forces and in intelligence agencies, they just say, whoa, enough is enough. We got to deal with this insanity, you know, the insanity of the world. What benefits a man if you gain the world and lose your soul? And I really feel that.
I see that in some people too, that you know, who are in positions of power, who are both military and politically, who I think are quite shocked and sort of just can't kind of close their eyes to the lies now, you know, and are really having second thoughts. I see that in the comments and some of the things people say that they realize, you know, enough is enough. This is just too absurd, you know. But
I was just going to ask you, like, talking about that, have you, because Alex Jones, I often listen to Alex Jones' show. You can listen to him live anytime. Have you ever turned him on?
No.
Jim, that Prison Planet, www.prisonplanet.com. I mean, it's like the one news source you have of what's happening in the other movement across America. And Jones was just saying what you said. He was saying that last evening. He says, like, there's so many people. Because apparently, you know, there's been a gag order put on the firemen and police of New York City, because they've all realized now that, wow, there were bombs. Like, there's so much overwhelming evidence, and they witnessed it. But there's been this gag order imposed on them that they're not allowed to talk about it, or they can lose their jobs. Yeah. because this guy, this Giuliano guy, is running, I guess, for president, and he's supposed to be the kind of big hero of 9/11 and the big hero of the firemen, but they want nothing to do with him. But anyway, that was just another thing that on Alex Jones. You should listen to his show sometime.
I've been to his website, but I should listen. Yeah, I mean, well, that's one of the things that struck me when, you know, when I read the some of the material about the critique of 9/11 is that how many firefighters claim that they heard explosions in the towers, from downstairs.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't one person saying this. There's several of them, and very disturbing, very provocative, you know. I was like, again, so why isn't there an international commission of, you know, open-minded people to look at this, not some sort of fixed phony thing like the 9/11 commission, a real investigation of this, you know,
At every level, the fact that that wasn't done just confirms that it's a conspiracy and a cover-up. I mean, it just gives you further evidence for the fact that it was a conspiracy. I mean, if you take the 9/11 commission report, that very superficiality of that report and the obvious ignoring of profound issues that were raised just provides more evidence of the cover-up. It is evidence of the cover-up. And if you follow that and you see all who covers up, you know, it just is this such an insidious thing that's like none of the major media will report the truth of 9/11. They won't, you know?
You know, it's interesting.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's interesting how, you know, even in that regard, how it's been pointed out that after Pearl Harbor, there was an investigation, a commission was convened, and I think it was convened within like 30 days, and the Warren Commission to investigate the Kennedy assassination was convened within days after the assassination, and the 9/11 Commission was convened 444 days, I believe, after 9/11.
And wow.
Really,
I didn't know.
Bush and Cheney never testified under oath. Bush and Cheney refused to testify originally.
Wow.
It was only because of the pressure from the families of the survivors that they even, deigned to speak about this, you know, and still they didn't testify under oath, which means their testimony is basically useless, you know. I mean, that alone, to me, you know, before I even had any inkling that, I mean, I just sort of dismissed the idea of conspiracy, but it seemed too outlandish to me. But that really disturbed me, is that why are these guys not willing to come and speak under oath? Why are they pretending like that? You know, they're acting like they got something to hide. Why? You know, and why is there all this resistance? And then when they finally appointed people to the commission, why do they, you know, put some fart catcher from New Jersey on there who was basically their inside guy? You know, like, I mean, the whole thing is so rigged. You know, I mean, as I say, we've been through this before with the Warren Commission, which was, you know, started with a fixed conclusion before it investigated any of the evidence. You know, I mean, it's completely disillusioning and soul destroying in the sense of it's.
It's soul destroying.
It's very.
That's kind of what's happened. It's like, you know, it's like the soul of America. You know, it's like the destruction of the soul of America. Everything and the goodness in America and the goodness in Americans as a people. And this is soul destroying what's happening in the country today. Around the world.
Yeah, around the world. But if somebody in my family had been killed in 9/11, or if somebody in my family had been sent off to war because of 9/11 and lost their life. I mean, I don't know how I could possibly, you know, live with this. Like, I mean, there just has to be, you know, some sort of accountability on some level. And of course, I mean, somebody in my family did die because, you know, it's the human family. It's like the uselessness of it all. Eh? It's like it's so disturbing.
Yeah.
And yet there's no accountability, and there's all these people who are not nuts. You know, like, I think the thing that really convinced me was, like I say, when I read David Ray Griffin's book, and I mean, David Ray Griffin's a very, prominent theologian, scholar, like a guy whose work I really admire. Like, I think he's quite a brilliant guy. And, he started looking at this with an open mind, and his presentation is anything but hysterical. And now he calls the 9/11 commission, however number of pages are in it, 875 or whatever, the 875
page
lie. He has an article where he identifies 100 different outright lies in the 9/11 commission.
Yeah.
It's like, why don't people wake up, and challenge this? Like, I mean, and demand,
I mean,
a real accounting, it's like, it's bizarre how,
It is. I can't grasp it in a way, because it's like, whoa, we're the police. Who do you call? There's so much overwhelming evidence there. Overwhelming evidence. It's like there's absolutely nothing of the original story that has held true. There's no evidence on their side to support the story they concocted. Everything was the downing of the two buildings, the downing of the third building, the imaginary plane in the Pentagon, just everything. There's nothing that holds true.
It's interesting, though, because it's like, the guy who really understood media was Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's Minister of Information, who said that if you tell a lie often enough, people will believe it, and it's like, about a year ago, I was watching this documentary came on I don't know what channel it was, like the Discovery Channel or something. It was about the Kennedy assassination. I'm interested in the Kennedy assassination. I thought, I'll watch this. So I started watching it. Like, about 2 minutes into it, it's a British one. And this guy says, there's no evidence that Jack Ruby had anything to do with organized crime. I just turned it off. It was like, give me a break, That is so completely not true that it's like, there's no evidence that Hitler had anything to do with the Nazi Party. I mean, it's basically the same statement, It's like,
I mean, just because
somebody says it doesn't mean it's true. And this is, again, it gets back to this about the most important thing to know is what we do know and what we do not know. And it's like, there's all this incredible lying going on all the time if you're not horrified by yourself, you'll definitely be horrified by other people. I mean, that's my reaction to it. It's just like, good Lord, and I don't think you can change this in a ballot box. I mean, there's just something so fundamentally fraudulent and corrupted. And this is one of the better countries in the world, we're talking about the States. It's the same in Canada. It's the same everywhere. But the United States is such a powerful and important country, and it's just like, it's a shame that this has happened there, It's just if you really loved America, you couldn't help but be horrified by what's going on there now. This is supposed to be a leader in the world in bringing freedom and democracy to people.
It's precisely the opposite.
There's just no moral authority there. They've completely lost it, Like, I mean, if they ever had it, it's been slipping for quite a while, but has done it in forever, Like, I mean, the clique of evil geniuses that run the American government,
very crafty for sure.
they're really good.
They're
getting out
a little bit.
They
should get a life, a life, How people could be. It's so funny. It's so peculiar.
George Bush calls himself a Christian, He believes that Christ saved his life and turned around. He was an alcoholic and a drug addict. Of course,
allegedly. I didn't know that.
Oh, didn't you know that?
Well, I know he had his cocaine thing. I'd heard But I mean, I understood he was a heavy drinker now. That's what Chavez says all the time. He calls him the little man. That's what Chavez says. And he's an alcoholic, Chavez says. And I don't
think he's an alcoholic. He's an alcoholic. Recovering alcoholic. No, he is. He talks about, but see, that's this whole thing is that he talks about Christianity and accepting Jesus saved his life because he was an alcoholic and his wife was going to leave him and this changed his life, and that's the strength of his faith is because of this transformation in him due to his acceptance of Jesus. But there again, like I'd say, okay, he accepted
Goodness.
Jesus, but I think he only accepted the part that stopped him drinking. You know, I think he missed some of the other parts. But you know, that I mean, you know, that's why I kind of like, you know, when somebody tells me that they're religious, I'm thinking, well, what does that mean? You know, I mean,
yeah, what does
know,
that mean to someone? Yeah,
there are a lot of people who say that they're not religious who strike me as being more religious than people who are religious. You know, like
yeah, exactly.
You know, in the they may not say that they believe in God, but they conduct themselves so much more moral and appealing way in terms of morality and spiritual values. You know, it's
I mean, that brings one thing is see, I think the elite intentionally tries to perpetrate the myth that religious differences are the causes of the war, but really that whole thing is fanciful. That's not the causes of the war. The whole causes of the war are the elite. Okay, and then they foster you know, paranoia about Muslims and Christians and Jews, but I think they want to undermine religious belief and portray religion as the cause of war, whereas really I think the world will change when real Jews, real Christians, real Muslims, real natives, people upright of heart, men and women of goodwill of whatever faith you are, we join together through the world and say no, you know, the I don't see religion as the cause of international hostilities. I see the criminality of the governing elites. That's what I see, and I see them as intentionally deceiving humankind about the causes of war to cause this, you know, problem between different religions and ethnic groups. That's how I see it now.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I agree with that, because I think, like, I mean, I think I think your main point is right. I mean, I think, you know, that these things are presented, they're kind of like, you know, there's shells on the board and people are moving them around and saying, you know, it's, look, these religious differences are causing all this. But if you really want to get to the root of it, money and power, that's what it's always about in the end.
Money,
you know,
sex, and power.
Money, sex, and power. I mean, it's really pretty basic, you know. There are definitely all sorts of things that pass themselves off as religious. I mean, if you look at what is taught in these fundamental Islamic schools, you know, these are very dangerous people and very dangerous thoughts. But if you look at the top of the fundamentalist Christian churches or the fundamentalist Jewish churches, none of these have anything to do with the esoteric origins of religion. I mean, these are deviations and distortions.
That exist
under the name of Christianity or Islam or Judaism. I mean, like, think of how far these people are from the esoteric origins. I mean, you know, if you're a fundamentalist Jew who believes in, you know, killing Muslims because they're your enemies, do you really think that person has a grasp on the Kabbalah and the teachings of the Kabbalah and that the amazing, representation of the nature of the soul and life and what it is to be upright in heart? I mean, it's the same as the fundamentalist
Christian.
Absolutely
not.
Do you think they grasp the Gospels? I mean, please, you know, like, I mean, they grasp some sort of distorted version of it that you know, that they then use to justify, you know, their slavish devotion to their lower chakras, like to the pursuit of
money, sex,
sex,
and
power.
Yeah.
And it's like, I like what you said about the heart, like it's in the middle, you know. So you need a change of heart to turn the direction. Like you have to overcome, you have to take the power away of these lower chakras and live in the higher ones and develop these higher aspects of yourself, you know. But in order to do that, you have to empty yourself of your attachments to these lower forces. You know, you have to get over your attachment to money and sex and power and everything that goes with it, and to know yourself by opening your heart, by enlarging your heart and you know, knowing the other dimensions of existence and the other dimensions of self.
I noticed, just to try to call us to time here a little bit, I noticed it's after 5. I'm going to give out these numbers, Jim, and we'll just see if anyone calls in to share. In the United States, it's 877-876-9673. 5227. In Canada, it's 888-810-8322. Okay. Yeah, we've gotten off a little bit. But I was hoping to talk about Blavatsky and the zero-point concepts in her work and such.
Yeah, for a couple of guys who don't
sure,
know anything, we just spent 64 minutes talking about everything that we know.
Get into the political side again, but I live with that outrage I feel sometimes now. I feel my heart so expanded at times. I just feel the injustices of it all. You know how Gurdjieff talks about bearing the sorrow of our endlessness, eh? Mm. And it's just like this sorrow of our endlessness, the uselessness of all this unnecessary suffering and destruction, you know, and it's hard to grasp. I was happier when I was more awakened in myself. I was less horrified then than when I woke up to the larger problems of the world, you know, and it's hard. I have found it hard at times going ahead, and you have to maintain heart and, you know, cultivate that sense of self within the heart and be connected to your breath and not let all the craziness of humankind, you know, wear you down or sicken you or cause you to turn to fear and such. You know, but at the same time, I really believe as a planetary process, we need that quantum leap in the awakening of human consciousness. And I do believe that the false consciousness system, as Blavatsky explains, is centered in the mind. The mind is the great slayer of the real, and that mind has been intentionally conditioned and deluded. And we have to overcome that conditioning and that process of awakening in the heart. And then that awakening in the heart, I believe, leads to the illumination of the mind and the use of the mind on the higher level. In a way, people use only the lower aspect of the mind in how they're conditioned, and we have higher faculties of the mind that we can attain once subsequent to the awakening of the heart. Also, a couple other notes. I didn't mention this to you, Jim. I did a foreword to a really nice book I'm holding in front of me called The Voice of Heart by Neil Stephen Cohen from the States.
Oh, okay.
And it's got beautiful lotus on it. And at the bottom, on the front page, just under his name, it says, "Foreword by Dr. Christopher P. Holmes." And I have the foreword to this book. And it's an absolutely beautiful book I'm looking at now. And it's an amazing, such an interesting book, because it's written from the perspective of the heart in us. Oh. So it's spoken from the heart. It's which gives it a really curious kind of perspective and makes it a practical kind of teaching. All about, Neil Cohen is a kind of transformational teacher and psychologist, or I'm not sure he's a psychologist, a transformational teacher in the States. He's just moved apparently to California, and he wrote, I invited him on our show. I'm hoping he's going to be over the next few shows, because he wrote me and he had been reviewing my website and was really taken by some of how I described, like, the physics of the heart and the zero point. And he wrote back having some absolutely brilliant ideas into, to quote, the mapping of the toroidal energy grid in and through the center of the heart has exact psycho-emotional correlates. Mainly he's talking about all this concept of the emptiness of the heart and the grid around the heart and how all our emotional conflicts and such might affect the physics of the torus of the heart.
Wow.
But anyway, in a future show, I hope that we'll have Neil on with us. And yeah.
Yeah.
I want to mention that today. Another note, I'm working away at my Divine Mysteries, trying to I've added a couple of recent chapters. One chapter which I wanted to get into today was some of Blavatsky's writings about light and about the nature of the sun. And boy, it's neat for me to go back to reread The Secret Doctrine, eh, Jim? It's like, as I go back now, my understanding and comprehension is like so much more advanced than it was when I began working on The Secret Doctrine 25 years ago. I mean, it's just a thrill to reread that book. So much of it is so absolutely contemporary in terms of Blavatsky's critiques of materialist science paradigm. It's just so profound, you know.
And
anyway, it was published in 1888.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Commentary.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
Yes,
we have a guest here.
Right. Okay. And I think that you're exactly right about most of what you've said. I think that you have to learn how to feel from the heart rather than to think about things intellectually. Yeah. It's very easy to read Gurdjieff and Madame Blavatsky and all those other people who have very profound statements. But on the other hand, you can run your mind around in circles forever with ideas and never get to that calm place of peace in the heart.
Yeah.
And it is always a nice place to go, to the place of where the peace beyond all understanding. And actually, absolutely nothing happens there. If you want to be in the world, you have to live it down here. But it's a nice place to go to visit.
Yeah. We need to be nourished by having time that we connect with that experience and still the mind and connect back to the breath and that inner feeling.
Yeah, it's very important because of the fact that it allows us to move forward. But on the other hand, we wouldn't be down here if we came here to be in that spot all the time.
Well, I mean, I think we could learn to be in that space and cultivate it. I think the experience of it grows and grows, and then you can be in this world but not of it. Like, you can live with that inner experience of that.
Well, sure. Actually, it's very hard to be within this world without it.
It is.
Because
especially
the
all
the
craziness
have so much
around
so many fears, and they run wild, so therefore they can never look or see themselves or see the world in a perspective outside of their own, as the kahunas would say, their own subjectively chained binders imposed on the robotic animal self, which actually is basically where all our emotions lie and all our contact with the higher self lie. But on the other hand, it is eminently programmable and often can lead us totally away from who we are.
Yeah. Yeah, so we have to try to undo that programming and conditioning and reestablish that.
Right, that's what our egos are there for, to keep that little wild dog that lives within us from going wild and teach it to be cooperative and move into loving and move into cooperation so that we can all work together to change these unfortunate situations that do indeed exist.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there are people like ourselves feeling the same thing around the world, and our numbers are growing.
Well, absolutely.
I believe
this is the first time I've ever heard, you know, I've seen fractions of this. I haven't, you know, we haven't gotten to David Icke's yet, but you're getting pretty darn close.
Yeah, I know. I don't want to get quite to the reptilians at the moment.
Right, yeah, I know. That's a little gross. It might be true, but on the other hand, most people just freak out, and the idea is to lead them onwards, not to make it where they go into a panic.
Yeah, I hope in the way we try to deal with the subject and trying to do both a bit, like provide that shock a bit, but then try to give some teaching, like to come back to the heart doctrine and, you know, to be solid in ourselves, to have a teaching to help us be strong in the face of that. I hope that, you know, I hope we don't leave people terrified because there's enough terror now.
Well, that's right. We got a government that inspires terror, and we have other people on other sides apparently, or so they say, inspiring terror, so that we will all be moved into a safe state where we're ruled by terror all the time. And we need to get away from terror and start getting into something that's a lot more beautiful, because creation happened to create beauty, not to create ugliness.
Yeah, exactly right. And there's such an abundance in life. It's like there's such abundance in life that we could all have such rich and fulfilling lives if we didn't have all these other problems.
Well, yes. If you want to look where hell is, it lies within. If you want to look where heaven is, it lies within also.
Yeah.
It's a question of what part that you go into that determines where you live. And if most people live in hell, unfortunately, when your eyes are open and you're watching the world, you're going to see something that looks a lot like hell.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There's beauty all around.
But we do at the same time. Like I really believe in truth, and I believe in a way that as truth emerges, you can't go back in a way once you know truth. You can't hide the truth. And the more and more people
for you. If there's a snare that's hidden for you, you're best not to step on it, and that's what the truth is about.
I'm sorry, I missed it.
If there's a snare that is hidden for you that will trap you up, you're best to avoid it, and that's what knowing the truth is about.
Yeah.
To help people avoid the snares so they can move forward into what life can be instead of how we have made it.
Yeah, we see, you know, humankind as a species, we need to mature. We need to make that quantum leap to the next level that we wake up collectively and learn to live.
We're destroying the world through the environment. And we're destroying many people on the same course.
Exactly. It's very discouraging. So we need to stay upright of heart and try all to be part of
our heart and food so that it feels loving rather than abused.
Yeah. Jim, anything you, any comments or anything you'd like to?
Well, I agree with the caller. I think
that snare comment
reminded me of the Henry Miller quote, which is that freedom without self-mastery is a snare and a delusion. Do we want power over others, or do we want liberation? The true liberators want to establish a world in which there is neither master nor slave. And he goes on to say that, you know, in the future, the true liberator will murder whatever is murderous in human nature, you know. Knowledge is one thing, but opening the heart and the emotional acknowledgement of all this is quite another thing. And we have to know that truth of the heart, too.
Yeah, knowledge, wisdom, and understanding are all different things.
Yeah.
And all three are needed, not just an encyclopedia. No matter how well it is written.
It's interesting in Kabbalah how each of those, wisdom is associated with Chokhma, the Supernal Father, the Sephira. And then understanding is Bana, the Divine Mother. And then knowledge is Dat, the 11th invisible Sephira. So those three are wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. And in Kabbalah, they're all discrete. And they're all in the way. Wisdom in Kabbalah and Judaism, wisdom and understanding are both within the heart.
Right. And that connects with the Tefereth. And
exactly.
Basically, those three are the Trinity, because when you get up to Ein Sof, you're up to a void where there is no personal identity and there is just peace. And everything is calm and totally peaceful, but nothing happens. And I think even the Creator got bored with divine peace all the time. So he wanted to do something different. And so you can't curse creation as evil. You can just say that because he's given us free will, we haven't gotten very good at it.
No, No, we haven't attained our free will, too. It's interesting. I see man is said to be given free will, but then because of our conditioned state, none of us really attain that free will within ourselves.
Well, we haven't evolved much beyond the animal, and we haven't evolved much beyond the ego, which is the satanic free will.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't moved into the state where free will is the exercising knowledge, wisdom, and understanding to create beautiful things rather than ugliness, and to create love rather than hatred.
Yeah, beautiful. Nicely expressed.
And that's what we will move towards. Hopefully
we'll
do it to this world, but we will all do it sometime or another.
Yeah, we need to remember that. Like, well, for me to remember, life persists even after this world. Maybe come back, keep up in the battles.
And we don't have to live in our fears.
Sorry?
And we don't have to live in our fears.
No, we don't.
But we
need
to be aware of them, because some of them are quite real.
I believe, like I describe in the heart, there being a bliss sheath, which is described in yogic literature as a mass of unemergent light. And I think the more our consciousness exists at that level within ourselves, we feel that inner blissfulness. And if that experience is refined enough, it's like everything is filled with blissfulness.
Well,
it's like
right.
a yogi. Sometimes you see little yogis, and they're just
in a way. You get rid of the anger and hatred and jealousy that can dominate the heart. And you cure the heart. Then you find the divine light within it.
Yeah, exactly.
But going after your heart's desire when your heart is diseased and sick and suffering and full of pain and anger and anguish will probably bring what your heart is concentrating on, like attracts like.
Yeah, what is within your heart, so shall it be in the way.
That's right, so clean your heart first, and be open to the love and the understanding and the wisdom and the knowledge. And then give that to the world so that you may be a light shining unto it.
Yeah. Beautiful.
And may burn out the residue of the ugliness from other people with a gentle healing light and not a light of fire.
Yeah, well, I believe at higher levels there may be a fire in a certain sense.
Oh, actually, they do some fire. Adam Kunalini is very famous for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's not encouraged that you court her, because of the fact that he usually is most unforgiving in the cleansings and usually puts you through a terrible time.
Sorry, who does that?
The Kunalini serpent power.
Oh, yeah.
Which even the Kabbalah, even the Kabbalah is talking about when they talk about the white thunder slash going up, going back and forth through the chakras. But on the other hand, in general, the people who have it prematurely opened usually have a great deal of trouble recovering.
Yeah, I definitely don't advise for people to try to raise the Kundalini energy.
Do it have enough problems.
Say again?
The people who accidentally do it because they're almost ready have enough problems.
Yes, they do. Yeah, you see even how that happened to Gopi Krishna. Because
what?
Gopi Krishna, when his Kundalini rose, in a way he wasn't ready for it, and he opened his brow chakra and had all these visionary experiences, but was so overwhelmed and couldn't cope with reality at all for months or even years until he kind of regained his, or I wouldn't want to call it sanity, but was able to anchor his consciousness.
He was barely able to handle reality, and so therefore he was minimally competent, which some psychiatrists would call insane.
Yeah.
But he never really truly met Kundalini insanity. He just met a whole lot of difficulty in functioning.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't believe I stress the awakening of the heart, becoming established in the heart. And subsequently to that, I speak more of the illumination of the higher centers, because I believe the light of the heart, if we awaken in the heart, the light of the self then illuminates the higher faculties of the mind.
Well, the energy must be centered in the heart instead of the ego. When the energy rises, otherwise it is most destabilizing, because Kundalini does tend to destroy your ego.
Yeah.
And most people need it to survive.
Yeah, you know, as they say, the ego makes a good servant, but not a good master. Like, the ego needs to be in service of the self, and if we awaken, if we work on ourself, like, I come from the background of the Gurdjieff Fourth Way teaching, and in that, you work a lot to struggle with negative emotions, to rid yourself as much as you can of negative emotions. I see that as a critical...
And change it so that you no longer feel that negativity.
Yeah.
And
I think we can dispel that, the negative emotions and negativity, through consciousness and self-remembering or other methods.
Right, okay, well, that's all I really have to say, and I appreciate
Well, thank you for calling in, sir.
I noticed you wanted to get a little bit more back to the spiritual, but is it also important to affirm what you said about the rest, because it is also true.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't want to focus on that, and it's nice. I appreciate your comments and bringing it back to the heart teaching, because that's the real focus of this program, and even our intention of going into the other is to try to kind of shock people.
When our heart is clean and pure.
Sorry?
When our heart is clean and pure, these problems will disappear.
Yeah.
And every person who cleans out his own heart is, through their energy wave, cleaning out other people's hearts at will, because we're all part of group consciousness, and there is no one that can make a change without affecting the rest.
Yeah. I believe we're all connected through the heart in that way. That's how I would say all humankind is part of one human heart, that we're all at some deep level entangled through the hearts of humankind.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. You have a good night.
Yeah. Goodbye. Jim.
Yeah.
Okay. That was nice.
Yeah, it was great. It was very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, we had some guys.
We don't get many callers to play. We ever get good ones.
yeah, really, haven't we? Yeah.
Yeah, we've had some really, really interesting commentary from people and interesting points of view. It's very affirming to hear that there are people out there listening and, you know, kind of responding on that level to things. I mean, you know, to get back just a little bit to, the point you were making about the... I mean, when we talk about these political things, my own point of view on all this is that, you know, I used to be a somewhat political person, but I always had sort of an interest in it. But, I mean, now I would say, more than ever, I just sort of see the relativeness of it all. I see it. It's important on one level, and in other ways it's not important. It's not that it's not important. That's not the right way to say it, but it takes its place. And what that caller said, you know, if I could purify my heart, I could make a contribution to humanity and to relieve the suffering of His endlessness, our Creator. But on the other level, you know, you have to kind of understand that the rule of sleep and the illusions under which people live and by which they deceive themselves about the nature of things. It's important in that way. And, you know, you have to recognize that there's a lot of suffering in this world, needless suffering, and people's willingness and ability to rationalize their crimes against others, you know, that's sin.
Yeah.
It is. It's a sin against God, it's a sin against nature, and it's a sin against human beings, you know, to rationalize these things. It's just wrong, you know, and you can't justify it, and I see that's
where you see the real psychopathology that rules humankind is the willingness of people to do the most horrific things to others and then to try to justify it, you know, like
yeah.
as if it's somehow, you know, somehow the right thing to do, or that, you know, oh, you'd have done the same thing in the same circumstances. Like, well,
that's what I see on CNN now. They're trying to justify now bombing a bunch of, murdering a bunch more people in Iraq,
yeah.
and they're
going to yeah.
justify it now before they do it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, before it was like, let something happen, and then you can justify it. Now we're going to justify it, then we can do it, you know.
Yeah, because they might do something.
Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, in case they might get a nuclear weapon while we have
yeah.
like 20,000 of them on their doorstep, you know, like, whoa. My
yeah.
goodness. I remember a guy in prison used to tell me, whenever you point your finger at someone else, you always have three fingers pointing back at yourself.
I love that.
Like,
that's great.
You know, someone pointing
so
at the you know,
yeah.
Iran, like you're pointing, but really you got three full fingers pointing back at yourself. Like,
yeah.
you know, we think they're terrorists. You know, what have
yeah.
they done?
Yeah.
You know? You
yeah,
know?
Sometimes criminals can be the most honest people, you know. It's like, what's that Dylan thing about, to live outside the law, you must be honest, you know. And it's like, you can't con a con man, you know. Like, I like that, about pointing, you know, finger pointing.
Yeah,
and,
the pointing of the
yeah,
fingers, yeah.
It points yeah. back to you, you know. And I mean, that's the other side of it, I guess, too, is that you see, you know, in this demonization and this finger pointing at other people, you see this denial of your own complicity or your own involvement in this, that somehow
yeah.
you're above all this, you know. I mean, that's
yeah.
that's just you know, that's the gratification of the ego and you know, the delusion of the egocentrism of us all, you know, that we believe that we're all like this on some level, as long as we stay asleep and as long as we're, you know, centered around our false personalities and our false egos.
Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to ask you a question. It came up in something that one of the emails you sent me, and you mentioned this about when you were first working on trying to understand the secret doctrine, you made a reference to some effect that you, as you were trying to understand this, like you were kind of in these like states of altered consciousness, and that you felt like
mm-hmm.
Madame Blavatsky was kind of informing you or talking to you. Is that,
yeah.
is that correct, or am I concocting
yeah.
that?
Oh, no, that's true. It was when I lived in Maple and I had my office out on that bus with all the windows.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just had those in terms of understanding the quantum vacuum and the light and just had experiences, immediate experiences of these things. I mean, now I experience it more routinely even and can turn my attention to experiencing these things. But at that time, they were kind of shocking kind of experiences, like radical experiences. I remember tears streaming down my eyes. I felt so gifted that I'd had those kind of experiences and insights into the mysteries.
So how Sorry? Exactly did this, how would you say this sort of manifested in yourself? Like, what kind of experiences did you have that you kind of felt this with?
It's funny because a lot of these things, as they say, are ineffable. So it's so hard to put them into
yeah.
words. And in a
right.
way, the words I end up putting them into are the words that may sound to people, well, like they're theoretical words, like,
right.
The fullness of emptiness.
Yeah.
The illumination, inward illumination by light. The experience of multidimensionality of existence. Like, these are all words I'm putting on, and they're kind of theoretical words, but they're what I, in a way, is what, like, was closest to what the experience of it was.
Yeah.
It's a different experience of myself. Like, at times now, I experience it. Like, I have this understanding of this kind of monadic essence in hyperspace within my heart, and it has certain spin properties. And I think through its spin properties, it's created different bodies around the center, and that somehow I experience myself differently. I experience like there's this kind of higher dimensional entity, and I feel in myself vacated, like I'm empty space, but I extend beyond myself. So this is part of it. There's a way of kind of experiencing, when I experience this more, it's like scintillating light everywhere. But, you know, these are familiar kinds of words. I mean, you study the mystical literature. People talk about the emptiness, the hollowness, the peace, the path, it's all understanding, the awakening to the bliss sheath in the heart, having experience of that blissfulness. And so it was kind of like the feeling of the blissfulness in the heart, the illumination of the mind, the kind of sensation of space and emptiness as fullness. So those are the kinds of experiences. I mean, I just remember one time just having kind of these tears streaming down my eyes, like I was describing. I just, you know, felt that I had been received grace. You know, where it's like you receive grace and you're kind of illumined, or you attain some higher level of understanding. You know, and it's not like when you have a mystical experience and experience these things, it's not the case that you can simply come back and put them in words. You can't. Like, they're ineffable. Or even that you understand what it was you experienced, because you don't have the words for it. You know, this is, in a way, has been like, why I've, you know, through 25 years since then, I've tried to refine my writing and understanding to be able to explicate it in the ways I try to now. You know, it may sound theoretical to people sometimes who kind of don't know it, but to me, these ideas aren't theoretical, you know,
well,
like, because there's a lived aspect to it.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think one of the really important things that I've learned over the years is that, and it kind of goes to what that our caller was talking about, and, you know, partly because of the nature of the format, and because we're speaking we're speaking, first of all, and that there's things imposed by that medium, but there's an intellectual quality to things that I think you know and I know on an emotional level, which is just as big, if not an even more important component of it all. It's like, I think at some point Maurice Nichols says something to the effect that the truth you learn through the work becomes more real as it deepens emotionally, something to that effect. And it's like it's translated into an emotional understanding. And it's not our usual kind of self-centered, egoistic emotions, but it's like a deeper, a higher level of emotion within yourself, and you begin to connect to that, and you begin to realize that. Like I feel I revisit that every time I go back and I reread material, or I learn something new in from esoteric sources. Like, it deepens in me emotionally. Like, I mean, I'm able to incorporate it in a more comprehensive way intellectually, but I don't even think that's the real value to me in a way. It's like it is in some ways, because I'm a writer and because I'm, you know, trying to communicate this, but in terms of my own life, in terms of my own living of this, in terms of my own trying to awaken, this takes place on an emotional level. We don't have a very good vocabulary in the West to explain these kinds of things, because we don't recognize the validity of these experiences typically. So, and it's like when you're talking about higher centers, is what you said, like it's inevitable. It's like Uspensky said, speaking of the higher centers would be like a blind man trying to describe colors. You know, it's outside of our frame of reference. So we don't have a vocabulary to explain it, and people don't have a vocabulary to understand it. You know, I was trying to think of, like, you know, I'm trying to I've been grappling with this idea of whether or not I want to confess something in this book. It's about you, but it's about your work, and it's about the problem of God's contracting universe. But, I mean, I was, you know, reading about the Holo movement, and in a way, like I have a sense of the Holo movement in David Bohm's work, because I've taken LSD, and I think I've seen the Holo movement. I think I've experienced it. Like, I have the sense of the dynamic nature of creation, that everything's in movement. You know, when Madame Blavatsky talks about thrills through every atom of creation, you know. In a way,
yeah.
I think I've experienced that. I've seen that, you know. I've seen the
yeah.
earth breathing. Like, I've seen the breath of life, you know. I've had these direct experiences. I mean, I had them, like, 35 years ago, and I just, like, I knew it was important, but I didn't have any kind of frame of reference to put it into. But now I realize, oh, yeah, perhaps that's why I'm attracted to these ideas in some sense.
Exactly.
Because the only explanations of these things that I experienced that make any sense to me. And I really,
exactly.
they were so real on an emotional level, too. I knew that these weren't illusions. I wasn't hallucinating, like, you know, that very loaded term. I think I'm hallucinating in my normal waking consciousness, and that this is more valid, that this is a more real, you know. I was seeing that beyond the material realm, beyond the illusion of the material realm, the solidity of everything, I was seeing the breath and the dynamism of creation.
Yeah, and it's like how Huxley describes, in a way, the mind is like a reducer out of this broader consciousness or deeper consciousness. So I agree that the reason I pursued this understanding the heart doctrine through the years is because of wanting to understand my own inner experiences and to find the language for it and to find the science for it. You know, now I look at what's taught in modern science and psychology, like the head doctrine and how the head is supposed to produce consciousness. I mean, it's just so completely fanciful to me now, because I have such a deep, alternative, direct experience that that's just simply not true, you know. And it's not just on an intellectual basis, you know, that I don't think it's true. It's in my being that it's obviously not true to me, you know. Whereas I think in what's happened in modern psychology and science is that people's approach to consciousness has been mainly intellectual. So they've all assumed that the consciousness somehow consists in the cognition and thinking and ego identity in the mind. So they have this completely wrong idea of consciousness. But if you have experiences of yourself as being a much different kind of being, connected in a much more primordial way to your environment, and you know, if you have direct experiences of these things, then that's kind of led me to investigate this for, you know, almost 30 years now, and also to cultivate those feelings. Because when I mean, I think I've had different periods of enlightenment through my life. I mean, I remember the first time was like before the Blavatsky period, when I lived in outside of Aurora in north of Toronto. And I was reading Broca's Brain by Carl Sagan, and I kind of formulated this whole concept of the problem of God's contracting universe and what that issue was, because I remember being out and being in the woods and outside and just having such a experience of myself as a part of the whole environment and the sun and the life and the smell and the breath of life. And, you know, you have those experiences that extend your notion of what you are as a being. So that's why we're drawn to the teachings we're drawn to, is to try to comprehend what my experiences have been for me. Yeah, it hasn't worked the other way. It hasn't worked that I kind of studied mystical teachings and then developed these as theoretical intellectual ideas. That's not how it came about. You know, I was educated in the mainstream of psychology, and at some point I realized everything I thought I'd been taught was empty and useless, like it was formatory. You know, and then I kind of searched to have a deeper understanding that was consistent with what I experienced in my own inner states and realization. I mean, think of what we've gained in knowledge through the last 30 years, Jim. Eh? I mean, we began with the Gurdjieff teaching, which in a way is the most practical first-level teaching, I would say, for people. Like how to study yourself in a practical way with the idea of struggling to awaken, how to work on yourself, how to struggle with negative emotions and the turning of the mind and connecting with your breathing and remember to be in a state of increased wakefulness as you go about your life. These are all kind of basics to beginning. But then that gradually, when it brings you to attaining self-consciousness, then you begin to experience the higher emotional center and the opening of the heart and the different quality to your emotional life. And now your emotions aren't just kind of personal emotions, you know, like feeling good or bad about yourself and self-satisfied, but there's another class of like impersonal emotions, you know. Of like experiencing the beauty in the sunset, or, you know, delighting in seeing an infant, you know. I love seeing little babies, how they're kind of like just, they're in that state of delight sometimes, and it's like you can feel it. I can feel things around myself in an extended way, in ways I never could before. So, you know, and it's subtle changes, you know. It's like we don't have the language in modern times, in psychology and science, we don't have the language that we need to understand these mysteries of consciousness. You know, and that's what we're trying to do, is to try to help develop that and refine it. And, you know, and the whole time, I would never want to pretend that I thought I knew these answers. I don't. You know, it's like where we began today. You know, the most difficult thing is to know what you do know and what you do not know. Well, I think I know a lot of things that I think I used to know kind of disappeared now. So, I think now I have for myself a whole new way of knowing directly through my experience of some of the things, aspects of what I teach. It's quite a process.
Go
ahead.
I was just going to say the process is so fascinating, just the changes that occur in terms of, you know, there's a quote from Gurdjieff. He says that when you first start observing yourself and studying yourself, you know, you see things and you try to explain themselves, you try to explain these things to yourself. And even though you don't grasp them correctly, it puts you on a different footing in a sense, and it reveals a whole different series of possibilities. And then if you work from there, then it proceeds to something else quite different. And you realize eventually that your initial understanding, you know, had elements of the truth to it, but it really wasn't properly grounded, you know, and that's what I see. So I think we're going to come to the end here, so I'll just let you conclude. But we'll be back just to talk about things we don't know about.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Okay, so this has been another broadcast of Zero Point Radio. I would encourage people to visit my website, www.zeropoint.ca. And I have some excellent books here. Particularly, I'd recommend to people a copy of The Heart Doctrine, which is just a profoundly valuable scholarly and scientific work that takes a broad overview of the issues of consciousness and the nature of the human heart. Okay, so other notes, we may have some guests on over the next few weeks, and I'm going to continue right through from now until August when the Theosophical Conference comes up in California. I'm going to continue to focus on Blavatsky, and next time I'll share around Blavatsky's writings about the sun and light, Jim. So maybe next time we'll come back to that and discussions again of the zero point concept.
Yeah,
okay, so again, I'd like to thank the guys at BBS Radio, and come on, you people out there, stay upright at heart. We can turn this thing around. We've got them on the run, as Alex Jones says. You know, they're on the run. It's coming out. The truth is come. The truth will set us free. So we need to bring out that truth and to abide in love. We don't want another cycle of violence and vengeance and destructiveness. That's just, will never bring about change. It has to be an ultimate kind of change. We need people to change in their hearts and awaken. Okay, so thank you, BBS. Thank you, James Moffitt.
Yeah, listen,
and
listen to BBS Radio. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, so that's over and out, 0 points. Material points without extension are the materials by which the gods and other invisible powers clothe themselves in bodies. That's what Madame Blavatsky says. That suggests that we all have zero-point centers, and we want to learn to cultivate awareness of that inner dynamic. Thank you, and good day.